ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world can be a very dangerous place.
The compounds in Myanmar are run by criminal gangs.
American forces snatched Venezuela's president.
You hit us, we'll hit you back, again and again.
But behind every conflict is a very interesting story. I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, if you're listening, takes a look at global stories from the safety of my basement. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pauline Hanson is now the preferred Prime Minister, that is over the actual Prime Minister and the official opposition leader, Angus Taylor. That's at least if you believe the latest Resolve poll. And yes, that's a fairly big if. But it's also not the sort of number the major parties can laugh off or ignore. So as One Nation's rise shifts from protest vote to serious and soaring political party, what is Labor's strategy to stop the bleed, and is it working at all? And while the fight plays out, another one is opening up over the budget. As a two-day Senate inquiry into the government's tax measures begins, with Labor still saying it's consulting, business groups lining up with their demands and the Greens preparing to partially flex their numbers. So where does the negotiation land and how does it play into the polls? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Greber. It's Monday, which means it's always a poll day, isn't it, for you and me? We're always talking about polls.
Poll. Yes, we're going to get into the Resolve poll result because I think it's significant. Look, it's a trend and that's why it matters. But to some really important and breaking international political news this morning. As we record this podcast, this ceasefire between the United States and Iran to end hostilities in the Middle East is all happening. This is something that will hopefully be lasting. It all happens on Donald Trump's 80th birthday. The US President Donald Trump has told the world via his social media platform Truth Social, and I quote, "Ships of the world, start your engines. Let the oil flow." Now, Jacob, we've kind of been here before, but to be fair, Iran has confirmed it. Pakistan announced it. There is a signing ceremony on Friday, although we're recording this Monday. That's quite a few days. Lots of things could happen. And it seems much more tangible than ever before, but there's a lot of devil in the details still.
Oh, what a great birthday gift, you know, that the president has given the world in his generosity. Look, yeah, massively overdue. Let's see if it sticks. The dynamics of this thing have exposed so much in terms of the sort of ability of Trump to force his way, the answer being not at all. It's taken months and months and months to get on top of this thing. It was always supposed to be quick and dirty and achieve a whole bunch of aims, that many of which we'll see if they've been achieved. I don't know what you think, PK, but it feels like a lot of them have not been achieved, particularly around the nuclear program, regime change. None of those things have fundamentally changed. And so the question is, does he get a deal that is in any way better than what was on the table many, many years ago with the original deal that was done with President Obama and the Iranians? Because that is what has driven Trump for so many years. He said that was a bad deal, if you recall. He pulled out of it in his first term. And here we are all these years later. Is the world safer? Is the region safer? And is the world economy safer?
Well, if you speak to experts, which is all we can go by, people who watch this very closely, the answer has to be realistically no. This agreement doesn't take us forward. I asked one expert, we'll be playing it a little later on afternoon briefing, you know, is it just status quo then? You know, which is still not good because you want to go forward. And he said, even status quo, it's not, right? Because it looks like money will flow back to Iran. So, you know, watch that space. Sanctions, this is the economy stupid for them. They are really in a desperate state. We've got a much more radical bunch of people in charge there, and there's a danger there. Has it weakened the ability of Iran after so much fighting to potentially survive? Well, that's yet to be seen. And then a devil in the detail kind of cliche. I say this because we don't really know some of the detail. And so for Iran, they just want sanctions relief, access to tens of billions of dollars in frozen oil reserves. It looks like they are likely to get that. Of course, sequencing will matter, what happens first, and there could be things that go wrong. And then there's a lot of claim and counterclaim still. So there's a bit of grey about, everyone's going to try and spin it that they've won, yeah? And Donald Trump needs to spin it that he's won. We know why. He's in dire political straits in his own country. But are we any better off than we were when this war started?
Yeah.
I can't find anyone who thinks we are.
No one thinks that, but I think we've just been through such a period of turmoil with all of this that there's a sense of relief that the worst part of it's over, I guess, and that fuel can start to flow through the Gulf and some of that rebuilding that has to be done of all that energy infrastructure. That's going to take time and it needs effort. And so I think that's why you're seeing our Prime Minister welcome this. Remember, he was very quick out of the blocks to support the goals or the aims of this action when it first began all those months ago by Israel and the United States. Our Prime Minister was very supportive of the ideas that underpinned that action, even though we weren't part of it and we weren't making the decisions.
And we weren't even given a heads up.
Apparently, we weren't even given a heads up. Today, he's saying, you know, we encourage this to result really in a durable peace. And I think the other piece that's interesting, and I guess this comes in the context, last week the Prime Minister was really quite openly frustrated by how all this process was going. I think he complained about having received multiple briefings within hours on one of the days last week where, you know, the strait was open one minute and then it was closed the next minute. Very, very frustrating. He wasn't hiding that frustration. Today we've moved to this potential deal to be signed in Switzerland in a few days' time. Penny Wong has jumped on, I think, from her point of view, the very important element, which is that it includes the conflict in Lebanon, southern Lebanon, which Israel's been pursuing. She's been worried about the long-term impact of that. The longer it goes, the worse it gets. So I guess, PK, that there is probably positive from the government's point of view, that it can get back to something vaguely resembling normal, which in the Middle East is always a vexed term, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there are the bigger questions, I think, in the longer term are also this fear, I think, that we all have, rightly, that emboldened hardliners in the IRGC will try to kind of even work harder to race for a bomb, right? That because they're harder line people who want that, and that the world will not be a safer place as a result of this action. And then the other issue, which I think is really one to watch, is this impasse between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu and that relationship between Israel and America, which seems pretty shaky at the moment. Donald Trump very much wanting us to know that he's been having a go really at Netanyahu. Israel is clearly not loving what's happening here. That really shifts things too, doesn't it, Jacob? And that also, I think, raises some question marks about the sustainability of all of this.
It does. And I think that's an interesting pointer to what is happening in the president's mind and what's happening in the American political environment as well, where, his involvement in this war has damaged him quite a bit among elements of what you'd broadly call the MAGA coalition that put him into office. I think his polls are extremely low. He's suffering a whole lot of negative press constantly about cost of living and gas prices. And he's seen a whole lot of the sort of people who were really boisterous, loud supporters of this president peeling away because of this war. So maybe some of this sort of macho, I'm talking firmly and roughly to Netanyahu. Maybe that's a little bit of a performance to try and sort of satisfy some of those voices, I'd suggest. Maybe I'm being a bit cynical there.
Performance? This man isn't a performer. What are you talking about? There's never been a performance. Look, I get your point. I think it's a good one. Now, Jacob, back to pressing matters in Australia. I mean, this is a huge pressing matter, can I say? Our economy is hugely affected, of course, by the traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. And just watch this space, because we don't know really how quickly it will start flowing through to help our economy. But, you know, you would hope that this is a positive sign, I think, for us, you know, going forward too. But let's just park that, because Jacob, you were right.
So yeah, this is quite
Mondays.
Yeah, and I actually like what you've done there. That's quite the segue.
Thank you.
You've made me think that some, maybe a big chunk, maybe a portion of it that's more important than we might be letting on, of this poll shift is driven to some extent by people just feeling economically vulnerable, exposed by this war. And you're suggesting maybe some of that might turn.
Yeah.
If this comes good.
If it turns, that is exactly what the government needs. But the actual latest Resolve Political Monitor, conducted from June the 8th to the 13th, it surveys just around 1,800 people, had some staggering results. Okay, so we had already in a bunch of polls that One Nation was ahead of even Labor and the Coalition, right? Now, Pauline Hanson, once seen as a kind of rogue, maverick, outsider to politics, is the preferred prime minister compared to the actual prime minister, as I say, and the actual opposition leader, Angus Taylor. She takes first spot. Now, it's important to say a poll is not an election result. This is one poll. But Jacob, I just, you know, as a student of politics over a long period of time, if you had told me even a couple of months ago, let alone years ago, that Pauline Hanson would beat the two, not just one, the two political figures that are leading the major political parties in a poll as the preferred prime minister to run the actual country, I would have told you that you needed to seek some help, and I had some numbers on me and I could help you. But I can't tell you that, because it's true. And the reason I'm so shocked is because it's real evidence that our politics has been upended. And I'm going to say something crazy brave. I don't think it's an aberration. I don't think it's just rogue. I don't think it's just temporary. I think politics is being smashed. And anyone who thinks that it's just a passing thing is completely deluded.
Delulu, you reckon?
Delulu.
Well, look, one in three people who were questioned in that survey said Pauline was their preferred prime minister, 33%. As you said, prime ministers behind her on 29%. There's a big chunk that's actually undecided, a bit over one in five. So I think that's also worth noting. The devastating part of it for Angus Taylor is that he only got 16% of voters saying he was their preferred PM. That is quite devastating for the Liberal Party and for Angus Taylor. So yeah, little wonder everyone's, you know, sitting up and taking notice. I think this is just another poll that reinforces that trend we've been seeing since really the end of last year. And I think we've talked about what the reasons are for it. I think they're quite, in many cases, quite rational reasons. People are
very rational,
feeling exposed and uncertain. They are not seeing. They're conservative voters, I think, mostly, but there's some Labor voters, and they're not seeing what they regard as leadership. They feel the Liberal Party is sort of irrelevant, not cutting through at all, no matter what they do or say. And to be fair to the Liberal Party, they've tried a few new things, but none of them seem to work. And then you've got the government struggling with this budget a little bit, I think. It's left a lot of people underwhelmed, and some even are angry. And so it's not surprising that the government's ratings might have taken a bit of a hit. But as you say, it's really congealing around this sort of idea that Pauline Hanson provides an alternative. I think I saw one commentator last week call it the sort of joy hate of it's a funny term, a funny phrase, but the joy of finding someone who you can back, who will then infuriate elites and smarty pant know-it-all, you know, that smarty pants know-it-alls who, you know, think that it can only ever be a contest between two major parties.
I reckon all of that is right. I think Labor has long been watching to see if this trend would take hold in Australia, but were very much of the view that they could stem it. But there's one key thing that happened, and that is the acceleration of inflation again. So I reckon they did have a handle on it when inflation was decreasing. I think the increase of inflation again and then interest rate rises has upended everything.
It's such an accelerant, isn't it, in our political sphere? Inflation, economic uncertainty creates that. And if you go through the waves of when Pauline Hanson has been successful, it's often connected to those economic periods of uncertainty, don't you think?
It definitely. I think this is chiefly an economic question and an economic conundrum for the government that they're facing. I don't actually think that some of the brouhaha around migration and race is the chief reason people are interested by some of these ideas. And I say chief reason because I don't think it's no reason. I think immigration has been a big issue in this country and is increasingly concerning to some people. So you can't dismiss it. But it's not the chief reason. The chief reason is a sort of disgruntlement around the system and whether it's, you know, working for people. And the government's diagnosis was to try and address that, but the way that they've addressed it is a big issue. Look, for some time I've been banging on this podcast about why I think we're seeing some of these trends, and inflation is always what I come to, and I know you agree, right? The economy. But I do think, and I've said it before, and not everyone agreed with me, but I really believe that the Prime Minister's decision to break election promises is one of the problems for him that will dog him. And I think what we're seeing in the accelerant is also linked to that. You know, maybe you can dabble with something once, stage three tax cuts that actually benefited people quite a lot in large numbers, so you could get away with that. But to think you can get away with it again, I think was crazy brave, and I think now erring on the side of crazy, Jacob.
Yeah, that's crazy, you reckon? That's a big call on it.
I'm making it.
Yep. And often you're right, PK. I guess I was often, always.
Well, all dear of listener, the research. Always. Okay, all of the research from all the people I speak to who do lots of research, and I mean across Labor, Liberal, and you know the sort of more public outfits, the focus groups, the people talking, they reckon the broken promises is resonating big time.
Yeah.
So the Fire the Liar campaign from Pauline Hanson, where she's collecting donations and there's a tit for tat about whether they're real or not and she's doubling down and all of that palaver, I reckon it is a real thing. The liar narrative is a dangerous one if it sticks. And I think it might be sticking.
So I was having a chat last week with someone who's been around, let's just say, and has seen a bunch of these cycles and has been very much in the room when a lot of these big types of decisions get made. This person reminded me, they thought, and this is an interesting theory, I'd like to get your view on it. This is one of three occasions where governments have felt essentially untouchable. And they've made big decisions. You could argue the first one, certainly in the lifetime that you and I have had covering politics, was probably when John Howard won control of the Senate. And it ended up creating work choices, which was seen very much as an overreach. But he did it because he felt he had Labor on the ropes. The Liberal Party and the Coalition control both houses of Parliament. Untouchable. Okay.
Yeah. Post Mark Latham, Labor in the doldrums.
There's
again.
No way these people will ever get their act together to come back into power. And so we can do what we're going to do, which we've always wanted to do for decades, and away we went. We know the story. That unraveled very, very badly. Kevin Rudd came out and won the next election and reversed a lot
in
of those changes.
In a landslide.
The second one, according to this person, this who was, as I said, very much in the rooms at these sort of moments, was when Tony Abbott won in 2013. Again, a big, big win. And the view at the time was, there is no way in hell the Labor Party's recovering from this. They are in so much strife. They're broken, busted, internally divided. And so the 2014 budget emerged and there was a whole bunch of broken promises. But the view was, we can do it. because the other side is so weak and won't be coming back. Well, 2026 might be, and this is your theory, I think, with your statement about it being crazy, 2026 might be yet another example of that, where the views, particularly since the last election, and we've seen it in these polls we've been talking about, how the Liberal Party keeps going down and down and down, that it's the same setup. These people will never get back into government anytime soon, so let's go for it and we can get away with breaking promises.
Yeah, and
they're arguing they're doing it for right reasons, but as you say, the headlines are there, broken promises. And
my issue is the broken promises, can I say, not the policy. Maybe the policy is wonderful. I know not everyone agrees. Yes, I'm aware business right now as we record is saying it's not, but I know lots of others who think it's great. It's fantastic to be changing these taxation arrangements. Others would say, why didn't you tell us at the election? Now, let's not re-prosecute all of that, but this whole our position has changed line is deeply problematic, and the electorate already doesn't trust the political parties. And so, you know, this political party, I think, is suffering the consequences of that. Now, I'm not declaring that they're going to lose the next election. I think it's too early to tell. I've seen Albanese turn things around. I think he has the capacity to.
You know, 2 years out, Patricia, there's loads of opportunity for them to turn it around. I mean, if they can put in place the sort of policies that get inflation down more quickly, and we're going to have a long debate about that because that's not always easy either. But 2 years from now, you know, maybe some of this pressure has come off in a big way. And the government's strategy at the moment, and I know this because they sort of indicated this to me, is twofold. One is don't tangle with Pauline directly. That's just a fool's errand. You'll end up looking very, very foolish. And I think actually that whole fundraising push last week is an example of that.
By the Prime Minister.
Yeah, he bit and he questioned her credibility, and that made her the victim. She's then able to make political hay, and she did so. So their first sort of idea was to avoid anything like that, and I think they'll try and do that going forward. And the other thing is really to give Australians a sense that there is a real choice here between what the government says it's doing and providing and what it calls the rest of the coalition or the rest of the conservative side of parliament's up to. And if they make that contrast clear, sensible Australians in the middle ground, in the government's logic, will stick with the government.
I mean, the other mistake, you're right, about like if you look at historical precedents, including, of course, the work choices example is, it's hubris 101, right? Getting sort of a sense of, I've got this. And I think that is one of the reasons it happened and why the Prime Minister was able to be convinced by the Treasurer and others that it was that they could get they could do this, they could sell this.
There was a lot of nervousness, though, I'm picking up.
Big time. I've heard people who've said, I was really worried about doing that, you know. Yep, absolutely, you're right. However, the big mistake they made is thinking that the collapse in support for the coalition and the infighting of the coalition, that was their opposition. They were in trouble. They could keep going, the government. They didn't count on a new opposition forming. They didn't count on that.
Yep.
And that's what's happened for One Nation. They have become the new, more formidable opposition in some ways. And that has been a surprise, I think, to the Labor Party. They did not think that was going to happen. They thought they had the research right to show that it was not going to be a huge problem for them. It was going to be, as one person who I'm telling you did research on this said to me, it was going to be a problem around the edges, but not fundamental. Just edges. See, it's like the Hunter, like some places, but not more deep.
And just to round out to your point about inflation and how the economy, stupid, is one of the driving forces here. One Nation's, I guess you'd call them, you know, where they're sort of at their weakest is in West Australia, which is currently, you know, in an ongoing boom state. Like things are economically rolling much better there than in most other states. It's got a big state surplus, thanks in part to the GST. We can have a whole argument about that. But it's in fiscal shape and the economy there is rumbling along. Lo and behold, there isn't that kind of 30+% support for One Nation.
Yeah, that is very interesting, isn't it? And it just shows that, that's a Labor state.
In fact,
government.
It's about half. It's about half, according to a poll out in the West this morning.
That is very interesting. Look, you know, long way to go, as we say, but something that is making, I think, the government very uncomfortable. And there's a big debate now inside the Labor Party about how to fight them, how to manage this, how not to bite the point you're making, not give it oxygen, but equally how to pivot to economy, 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 you know. And they've done a good job of avoiding culture wars or, you know, getting distracted by other things. Have you noticed they don't bite on Pauline Hanson's culture war stuff? They are strategic in some ways there, and that might be to their long-term benefit if they can address the economic grievances, which, of course, are very deep-rooted. Now, Jacob, another one to watch is Labor's budget, obviously, and the ongoing shenanigans around where they end on this. In the spotlight today and tomorrow, two-day Senate inquiry into the big measures, including the capital gains tax changes, negative gearing changes, the trusts. Business has put forward suggestions, and look, I don't know, are we that surprised? Business, not fans.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, I don't know how much of any of this is going to move the dial. The government seems to be sticking to its determination to get most of these changes through as they currently stand. The term that is thrown around here in Parliament and elsewhere is carve-outs, what gets carved out. The government indicated on budget night they'd leave a bit of space to tweak some of the things, especially around startups, but the business groups want bigger changes, including an ability to average your losses over many years, and they want other tweaks. It's interesting that they're offering these tweaks rather than saying don't do any of it at all. That tells you that they realise the political power that the government has to get this through Parliament, regardless of what they think or not. So they're sort of trying to negotiate here. I'd be surprised if there are big changes to this. And one reason I say that is because the government really isn't holding an inquiry of any depth or substance. No. It's a quick and dirty over 2 days. A lot of the witnesses are very, very supportive of these changes. There's not a lot of room for critics. And a bit like the NDIS inquiry last week, you know, the government's really, really pushing hard to slam this stuff through.
They are. They want to slam it through so that people can get used to it, move on, and the caravan moves on. That's always been the strategy. Although I think they're going to find it hard to pull off that strategy, Jacob. I thought it was possible that they could. As time goes by, I am less certain that this is just going to go away for them. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm honestly not sure. Because people do move on and journalists move on. But some of these changes are coming at a time when I think there's quite a bit of underlying weakness in the economy. You know, there's lots of money being spent on data centers and gizmo servers or whatever it is that go into these things. That's certainly creating a lot of activity, a lot of GDP as it's counted, but a lot of that stuff just comes from overseas, and you know, people are worried that a lot of the profits from all of this ends up overseas, whereas in the sort of more traditional parts of the economy, yeah, there's a lot of signs that it's pretty tough going. And so yeah, these changes, the politics, government wants to get it through, as you just said, and they hope that people move on. The problem is that if some of these problems percolate up, people will point back to the budget and say, there's some of the reason, there's some of the cause of this weak business investment and lack of job creation, and that's going to be hard for the government.
And that's it for politics now today. Jacob, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Fun as always.
Yeah, fun. War, economic disaster, topics. End of the war. That's more fun than actual war.
Well, and we didn't even talk about the soccer. We didn't even talk about the big win.
I know. I'm wearing
That's why I'm feeling more cheery today.
Look, I can't even begin to tell you the joy I feel at any success that we have at a sort of international level any time. But yeah, this is my favourite sport, hands down. And that Socceroos win, my goodness. Or as one person made a joke to me yesterday, which I have to share because it's so funny, after the shift in the kind of interest in recent years, it's so good. The male Matildas are so good.
I do like that.
That's very cute.
It's about as excited as I've been about a soccer game since the Matildas won that, what was it, the quarterfinal.
Yeah, they got close. And anyway, these dudes are amazing. And those goals were so. Can I just say one thing? And you know, full disclosure, I'm a Greek Australian, and you know, sometimes we carry some some trauma. But over Turkey, which has been lots of jokes about, can I say online, historically speaking? But have you seen their flex? Oh, we dominated. You dominated. We won the game 2-0. Dominated.
Okay, people. Okay. That's enough, PK. This is hubristic. Oh, you're Greek Aussie. You're Greek Aussie,
yeah,
sort of gloating
come on.
Here.
It's put it away. I mean, you lost the bloody game. All right, tomorrow Mel Clark is back with us to talk about all of the latest, and there will be a lot to talk about. Send your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au and we will endeavour to answer them. See you, Jacob.
All the best. See ya.